Good morning. We would like to welcome everyone this morning first to a special meeting of the Mesa City Council for Thursday, April 26, 2012. And the one item we have, I think Councilmember Richens is probably on his way. I haven't heard that he was going to be there, so we'll wait. The first and only item on the agenda for this special meeting is the approval of authorizing city manager to execute a memorandum of understanding with Westminster College. The lease of a city-owned building located at 245 West 2nd Street. Mr. Jevgeniak, you want to come give a short overview of what we're dealing with here?
Good morning, Mayor. Good morning, Council.
It's with great pride that we introduce our second university to our downtown area, and I'd like to have join us Dr. Forsyth, who's president of Westminster, and his contingency, if you will. He want to come on up, but we were great to bring Westminster with the three majors of transnational studies, international business, and environmental studies with two minors of pre-law and pre-med to the downtown. They'll be the first occupant of the Mesa Center for Higher Education, which we're excited to initiate. And I think this morning's action certainly gives us an opportunity to start down that road. And I think the expected occupancy date is the fall of 2013. Mayor?
When you say occupancy, I think that's the initiation time frame for actual moving in would probably be what? Year from now or into that building?
Fall of 13.
We're in the spring of 12 right now. I know you're going to start classes the fall of 13, but is that when the building's going to be ready? Or?
That's the anticipation, yes, sir.
Okay. Dr. Forsyth, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you want to introduce your cohorts?
Yes, I'd like very much to. This is Dr. Carolyn Perry. Dr. Perry is the Chief Academic Officer at Westminster College. She's the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculty and a Professor of English. And Mr. Kent Miller is a member of our Board of Trustees. At the public announcement on Monday, I was asked about some of our distinguished alums, and Mr. Miller is one of our most distinguished alums. He's a resident of Paradise Valley, so he lives in the area. Been a member of the Board of Trustees, and his encouragement and support really brought us to this moment today. We have a number of buildings on campus that are named after Mr. Miller and his wife, and a number of students who enjoy scholarship support because of them. So Kent has been a member of our team from the start as we've worked through our exploring the partnership with the City of Mesa, and we're delighted to have Kent here as well. Thank you. If I may begin with a few opening remarks, I want to begin by thanking the City of Mesa for your hospitality. I spent 35 years in the Army, traveled all over the world, and have been warmly welcomed in many places around the world, never more so than here in Mesa, Arizona. And we are convinced that this is an absolutely wonderful partnership for Westminster College, our college in Fulton, Missouri, and we are looking forward to continuing the planning process to establish a campus presence for Westminster here in Mesa. We were attracted to this because of your bold vision for downtown Mesa. It is truly transformational to think about using higher education as a way to engage and to continue to enhance your beautiful downtown area. We are excited to be a partner with you in that. We're also excited because your vision could potentially transform higher education as we know it today. Higher ed is in the midst of a sea change. To succeed, higher education institutions in the 21st century are going to have to transcend barriers which have divided institutions and communities and indeed disciplines. And your vision provides an opportunity for a new way to think about higher education with the city as a campus community and a number of different institutions working in different sectors of the higher education market for the good of all citizens in the city, in the region, and in the state. And so we're excited to be part of that venture. Westminster College was founded in 1851. We are the Westminster in Fulton, Missouri, the home of Churchill's Iron Curtain speech in 1946. We were founded to prepare citizens for useful service to the community through a high-quality liberal arts education. That was true 161 years ago, and it's true today. The nature of our community has changed. We are now a global community with students from 27 states and 70 countries assembled on our campus. And so we take pride in using the liberal arts to prepare leaders of character for service in the context of a global community. And it is that vision, that mission that we want to bring to the city of Mesa. Residential, undergraduate, liberal arts education with a global international focus. And so the programs that we expect to start with as majors will be international business, transnational studies, which is an interdisciplinary program that looks at phenomena such as economics, social justice, the environment, health, that cut across regions of the world and prepare people for service in business internationally, and a program in environmental science, environmental studies, with two minors in pre-professional preparation in pre-law and pre-med medicine. In addition to that, we will offer a large core curriculum of the liberal arts and sciences to prepare people for to be citizens who are critical thinkers and lifelong learners in a small classroom setting, which we think will appeal to a variety of students who are looking for a smaller, more personal approach to undergraduate higher education and may have particular resonance to those who are first-generation students as well. So we are very excited about our partnership with the City of Mesa, and we look forward to rolling up our sleeves and getting to work with you and the other partner schools who come on board in the next 12 months. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Good. Any questions for Dr. Forsythe? Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Just a comment. As I noted the other day, I'm also from Missouri, and in growing up, Westminster's reputation was stellar and is even greater today. And it really does exemplify leadership qualities in an institution to take the course that you have done in terms of meeting the needs for today, because really developing leadership in different disciplines is critical to the health of a community. And I really respect the idea of having choices for students of all ages to be able to attend classes in a smaller, more intimate setting. I think it offers a great opportunity for wonderful education and experience. And so I know, at least from my part, I'm very, very proud of Westminster and glad to welcome you.
Thank you, Councilman.
Councilman Richens.
I'm going to chime in partly to apologize for being late. It's my daughter's seventh birthday morning, and there are requirements at home. It was a Mickey Mouse pancake, but but this is really for her. I mean, she's 7 years old. In 10 years, when you guys are fully cranking, she's going to be looking at colleges, and so that's why I'm so thrilled about this initiative that the council. Because other than, I think I probably have the youngest kids on the council, and but really, this is you know, I know it's not meant to be a dig, but this is really exciting for Mesa's future, because one of the things that we've lacked is high educational attainment. And I think the article that described this rollout was spot on when it talked about developing this workforce for the future and developing higher wage jobs here. And you're a part of that, and thank you. I just want to thank you. I attended a liberal arts college myself. I love the format. I love that kind of curriculum and the way they think. And so congratulations, and we're really excited to have you here.
Thank you very much, Captain.
Thank you. And thank you. And thank you so very much, Mr. Miller. Thanks for coming over. Have you been over to the Arts Center at all for anything?
Yes, I was here about a month ago with the Westminster contingent. That's
quite a facility.
We got to get you and all your friends from Paradise Valley over for some over for some performances and stuff. We'll take care of that. We'll get you over here because that's one of the things that excites us, is the ability to utilize the assets that we have here. Mm-hmm. And I think some people don't realize that the part of the plan is not only to get college universities to locate down here, but to recognize we have a built-in base of assets such as our library, such as our arts center, that go along with light rail and those things that give the opportunity for a complete experience. And so we're excited. And I don't think that you would be sitting here if we didn't have those assets in downtown, if we weren't poised to go. So the thing that excites me is this is not part of starting from scratch.
Exactly.
We're building upon something, a foundation that was laid in a downtown that's just locked and loaded, ready to go. So thank you so very much.
We're excited.
We're excited to go through the process and to work with all of our educational partners. And I will tell you, I've gotten nothing but positive response from people from throughout the valley. As I was over in Phoenix at meetings during the week, the people who came up and noticed not only what was going on in downtown Mesa, but who was coming here. Your reputation precedes yourself. And when we give a little bit further background of it, then people throughout the valley are excited about you coming into town and the things that you represent. So,
right.
Vice Mayor, I see you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Just as one commented, the good doctor made a statement about the evolution of education, how it's been changing over the years, and what the future of that is. And we had a conversation yesterday that I thought was rather interesting, in that a university really is a collection of colleges. When you look at Arizona State University, it is the university, and it has the Fulton School, it has a business school, it has a number of colleges and schools underneath it. Downtown Mesa, in a way, is becoming the university with our colleges, our good colleges. And I don't want to list them because I'm afraid I'm going to slip of the tongue and name one out. So the two we've named already, Gary, I see you down there with your pen, are those colleges underneath. And what I envision quite possibly is where a university used to be defined by walls and all the buildings within that particular geographic area. This is really going to be a discontiguous campus where there are several buildings of used by different universities. You like that, don't you?
Discontiguous.
Yeah.
I'm trying to count the number of
the.
We have an English professor.
It was better than disconnected.
It's a word.
It's a word.
The English professor confirms
do.
It's a word. It's bad when we have to have English professors at our meetings now. Oh, I'm sorry. Were we interrupting?
Gary, I had such a great quote for you, and it's just gone, man.
Yeah.
There are going to be a whole bunch of colleges downtown. How about that? And the campus, all over the place. And the campus is really going to be throughout that downtown area and walking from one building to the other. So the strength of that is it's going to take advantage of our downtown, our light rail, but also, as the mayor noted, our assets like the art center, the library. So that does bring up a specific comment maybe to Mr. Brady that we need to look at in the future. This isn't anything pending, but how we adapt the art center, the other city assets like the library, and be prepared to adapt those to meet the needs of the universities that are coming in, since I think it's a great opportunity to share those resources, and also what we can do to make sure that this program, these universities succeed in their mission in downtown Mesa. So we need to have some more conversation about that in the not-too-distant future for their success. So I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, Dr. Summers. Okay, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll entertain a motion on item number one. Have a motion from Councilmember Glover, a second from the Vice Mayor. Is there any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Ms. Crocker, any requests to speak?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay. Have a motion adjourned from the Vice Mayor, second from Councilmember Higgins. All in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you so very much. Thank you, Barney. Mr. Egan, you want to come up here and join us?
I don't know if I want to.
We'll now call to order a meeting of the Mesa Housing Authority Governing Board, and we conduct these meetings periodically to hear reports and to take action on housing reports and plans and things like that, and that's what we have on the agenda this morning. The first one is to conduct a hearing and take action on a resolution regarding the City of Mesa Housing Authority's fiscal year 2012 Public Housing Agency Annual Plan. Mary.
Good morning, Mayor and Council members. I just want to give a quick overview of our program as before you make your resolution on this. The Housing Authority has approximately 1,600 vouchers. This past year, we've been very successful in streamlining and updating our procedures and making ourselves more customer friendly. We've added more members to our resident advisory board. That's going to be a focus that as we further develop our future, that our residents are involved in helping us develop in a way that best serves the Mesa and our housing. What we found is our budget is approximately $12 million. That's $12 million that stays in Mesa. I think sometimes when we talk about the vouchers, we don't know how much financial gain it actually gives to Mesa. So we want to be good stewards of it. So what you're seeing in our admin plan is some of the changes so we can be up to date with our HUD regulations, as well as how can we be more flexible. So this past year, we were awarded through the Continuum of Care, which is an innovative program. This we were one of the first awardees for our Shelter Plus Care. We're going to be doing that with Save the Family. So it's seven sponsor-based vouchers. We've talked about the project-based vouchers, and so we've put into our admin plan as well our annual plan the possibility to go for request for proposal so we have the opportunity when the time comes that we're ready to go. So I think that is one of the reasons we are really wanting to expand and get more input to make sure we're going in the direction necessary. So with that said, many of our changes that we made are because we haven't updated our plan for the last 3 years. So Mr. Egan's was very was there when we did update it so we can meet all the HUD regulations. Any questions?
Great. Any questions for Mary? Councilman Richens.
Do we have to make any adjustments to the plan as far as the Section 8 vouchers when we talked about helping a new leaf with some project-based vouchers?
No, it's included
in
here.
That's all included in there. I had a hard time opening Attachment A for some reason. It wouldn't load, so I figured that's where it was.
Right. It was a general statement about what procedure we would use for project-based vouchers. I mean, we've been working with the experts and also talking to our HUD office as well.
Marlis, thank you.
Thank you. And how does that go in with what we talked about last year about, or maybe 2 years ago already, getting, like, moving the chronically ill to the top of that voucher
list?
At
this point, we do have a preference for the homeless preference, which does include chronically homeless, which people who are chronically ill or have disabilities are encompassed in that.
Okay.
And we also have mainstream vouchers that deal with people with disabilities. So that was also, that's also in our annual plan.
Great.
So they do come to top of the list.
Thank you.
Okay. So since this is a public hearing, I'd like to ask Ms. Crocker, are there any requests to speak from the public?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay. Are there any other questions or comments from the council? Mr. Egan.
I always have a comment or two. First of all, I want to thank you for reappointing me to this distinguished group. This earlier group that I listened to reminded me of the story about John F. Kennedy when he had a gathering of worldwide scholars at the White House, and he stood up and said, "This is the greatest gathering of brain power in the world since President Jefferson ate breakfast alone." I've been on this committee now. This is my eighth year with you people, and I want to thank you for your vote of confidence. You probably didn't realize who you were voting for, but you all voted in my favor. Every year I say the same thing about the department, about the work that's being done, so I hope you won't remember what I said a year ago, since we only meet about once a year, except for a few exceptions. But it goes on, and the story is the same, that this is a good program. It's one of the best federal programs I've ever heard of. There's not much to do except for us to okay it. And the one-year plan has been approved by the advisory board, and I voted on yes on that, and I would vote yes today, and hope that you would give this staff a vote of confidence in their work, in which they're doing an excellent job, and vote in unison and vote for the plan. It's one of the few plans where it covers the whole city. You have people on HUD Section 8 throughout the city of Mesa. There's 15,500 some vouchers and $10 million going into our economy. And God willing, and I'd like to serve another 8 years on the committee, unless those people down in Phoenix, our legislatures, don't vote one day to succeed from the union, we can continue this plan. So I thank you, and I hope I'll see you again next year.
Thank you, Mr. Egan, and I want you to know that we absolutely knew who we were voting for, and we did it. We did so not only willingly, but knowingly, and we were happy to have you here with us.
That serves him right.
Okay, if there's no other comments, we'll declare this public hearing closed, and we'll entertain a motion to approve the adoption of the resolution. I have a motion from Councilmember Richens, a second from Mr. Egan. Any discussion on this? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Egan.
Thank you.
Yeah, motion to adjourn from Councilmember Higgins, second from the Councilmember Glover. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The Mesa Housing Authority Board meeting is adjourned. Next item on the next item is to call to order a study session for the Mesa City Council for Thursday, April 26th, 2012. And the first item on our agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the municipal court budget issues. And Paul, if you want to introduce everyone there sitting with
certainly.
You.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. It's certainly our pleasure to be here this morning. I think you all know me, Paul Thomas, Court Administrator. I have with me this morning Lenny Montanaro on my right, Deputy Court Administrator, and Janie Moreno on my left, Deputy Court Administrator, who also helped in the presentation this morning. Anxious to get started. We'll take the first slide. Good.
Got it?
That's the first slide. There you go.
Okay. Okay, next. The theme for this year, as we understand it pretty much, is innovation. Of course, innovation is a theme every year at the court, as I think you all know. And what we want to do in this first slide is revisit real quick innovations that we launched last year. We were here and told you about these. So we're basically here today to tell you that we've implemented them, they're in place, and they're performing. So this is revisiting what we proposed to you last year and updating you on the current status. Number one on the list is e-citation project. We've done this in conjunction with the police department, which is the automated handheld citation issuance in the field by police officers. It expedites that process, it eliminates errors, does a lot of things in terms of efficiency. It was launched as a pilot project with an initial rollout of 20 officers. Later in the presentation, I'll come back to this issue with a secondary proposal. But to note that we did put it together. We funded it both jointly with the court and police department with grant money to get it funded initially. And it's seemed to be performing at least the pilot very well at this point. The second item I'm going to have Janie comment about, this is was a huge undertaking at the court. It actually took several years to get to the point where we could actually do what's on this second item, and I'll have Janie comment about that real quick.
On July 11th, 2011, we converted 7 criminal courtrooms from paper case files to electronic case files. So this included not only new cases and documents that were filed as of that date, but we also had an existing 76,000 paper case files that had to be converted, and it came out to about 1.4 million documents that we had to scan. And I want to thank our judges and staff for the outstanding job that they continue to do with this transition to electronic case files. Some of the benefits that we saw with this is definitely a time savings. As you know, we're now spread across three floors in the court building. So in the past, staff would have to walk from the file room on the first floor to take files to the third floor to the courtrooms. Now it's available as quickly as typing in a docket number, and anybody can see any of the case documents in a file. And also one of a big benefit was it used to take anywhere on average from 3 to 5 days to get mail motions entered, matched with the file, and to the judge's desk for judicial review. With our conversion, now the average is about 1 to 2 days, and many times we get the mail entered, scanned, and actually available in the judge's queue on the same day it's filed. So those were the benefits that we saw with this. Thank you.
I'll make one other comment on that item. This was a huge undertaking that was largely under the supervision of Janie. And you can imagine managing 76 to 96,000 case files, 900 boxes of files, staging them, getting them ready for scanning, pulling them out, coordinating them to courtrooms. It was a huge logistic undertaking, and I have to compliment Janie's efforts in managing that over the duration, because it was a huge demand, and it came off fairly successfully, and we now enjoy the benefits of that type of automation. The next item is auto dialer. We've talked about this before, and I think the last time we were here, we talked about trying to recover from the loss of staff that placed calls to follow up on payments and delinquent payments and so on. we've implemented this in two phases. At one point, when we had staff doing this, we were placing about 90,000 outbound calls for follow-up on payments and other matters. That dropped down to 57,000 when we lost staff, and we have now recovered to 88,000 outbound calls. So we're almost back to where we were before, making up for the staff loss through the auto dialer that now places those calls. So, the next slide are the innovations we will be launching for this year. I'll have Lenny comment about those.
Well, the first one's the new case management system. And that is sponsored and primarily funded by the Arizona Supreme Court. And we talked about this for the past two budget sessions. While it's live now, Mesa assumed a leadership role in this, basically because of what the mayor said earlier, our built-in base of assets. So we're there. We have automated case files, and our judges are online where no other court in the state is that automated. So our target is July 1 of 2013 to roll out the new case management system. Next piece here is electronic digital signatures and fingerprints for sentencing documents. Currently what happens is the documents are printed out for signature, and for our more complex or severe cases, DUI, domestic violence, you have to get a print on a judgment form. We're testing technology right now so that we'll no longer have to print the court's copy out. They'll do a digital signature, get the print for the judgment, and it will be uploaded automatically into our document management system, eliminating the scanning process. Second piece here, electronic imports of forms submitted by the public directly into the court's document management system. For years, we've had templates of motions online for pro per litigants. So they go on, fill out a formal motion to continue, notice to set aside, request to set aside a judgment, and they file them. We have to take them, scan them, upload them into the document management system, and be queued for the judge to roll on. So utilizing the existing technology that was paid for through the enterprise system, found at the documents will be completed online, electronically sent to the judge's queue, and the value of this is a quicker response to the public when they're asking for a motion to continue, motion to set aside on prior convictions, things like that.
Yeah, I would also mention real quickly, I sit on the committee at the Arizona Supreme Court that oversees all the large automation projects in all the courts throughout the state. And I can say this kind of thing, electronic signatures, fingerprint technology, we are really out in front on this issue. I'm not aware of any other court that's basically where we're at in terms of this kind of technology. The next slide. This is an interesting slide. The challenge by city management this year was to come back with a recommendation of a project or something that would be a one-time investment that would produce a tremendous result with basically a upfront one-time investment. And when we sat around and we looked at what potential projects we might recommend to city management, there was no doubt that for us the best bang for the buck for the investment was going to be the continued rollout and completion of the handheld pilot project that I mentioned earlier in the presentation. There's another at least 70 officers out there that still issue paper citations, so we're still stuck in the paper world with that kind of process. So we really wanted to come forward and say that it's our belief that this project would produce tremendous benefit both for police and court in expediting the whole citation process if all the officers had the handheld devices.
I'm sure how this works. You have a handheld device. You basically swipe the swipe the driver's license, which has all the information on the on the magnetic strip on the back. It all downloads it. The officer just punches in the citation, boom, hits it.
And as you'll note in the notes here, when the officer uploads that information, it's immediately available both to the public and to the court. And it's in the court's database the minute they upload it at the end of every shift.
So if an officer's out in the car, at what, handheld, is it in the car? Is it be a Bluetooth or something to the car and then transmits from there, or does he have to wait till he gets
it? It's my understanding that there is some capability through if Wi-Fi is available, but typically they upload at the end of the shift, as I understand that.
They dock.
Right.
So. Okay.
They're about to issue.
I was going to say that.
They'll show you.
I asked that question. There's mass migration to the front here.
So we could issue this parking ticket.
That's in 2 months.
But why don't we talk about how it works today?
Absolutely.
And then talk, because that's the big difference is how things happen today versus the proposal before.
Well, I think unfortunately most of us know how it happens today.
No, know how the officer deals with it. You don't know what happens after the officer.
Gotcha.
I asked PD for backup today. So.
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, Mr. Brody, how the device currently works is that when the officer contacts the driver, we obtain the driver's license as well as the vehicle registration. The handheld devices have give us the ability to scan with an infrared scanner the barcode on the back, as well as on the registration. So, and that's pretty much every state that has a barcode. We can do that. That information is automatically populating the software, and certain drop downs that are not populated by the scan, such as location of the citation, the traffic stop, the violation, all of those are handpicked by the officer. Each device is personalized to the officer when they log on, so their identification as well as their signature is imprinted electronically, or digitally, I should say, on each citation. So in many respects, it cuts down on the user time, cuts down on the time that the drivers are waiting, standing by. And then that information, once it's secured, and the citation is complete, the officer prints via Bluetooth to a portable printer. That printer then will produce a ticket that's about 4 inches wide, one copy, and then we will submit it to the driver.
That is printer in the automobile or in the
currently it's on the motorcycles.
On the motorcycle.
So yes, okay. They're small. They're literally about that big. Once we have their signatures, we print that citation and we then submit it. We also use it for warnings, so it's not just citations. We also use it from an educational standpoint. When that citation is completed, the officer completes their contact. They then hit submit, and at that time, that information, that citation, is sent through wireless service into the cloud, the server, from where at that point that information is then sent down through three separate back-end connections, ILMs, I think they're called, from a technical standpoint. And two of those go to the court, and one goes to PD. The one in PD, it goes into our records management system. It replaces the data entry system that had
taken... talk about a little bit, because this is significant, because right. Today, if it's a hard... If today, if the officer's out in the field today writing that...
Absolutely.
...citation, what happens with it?
Officer writes a citation today. By the end of the day, upon completing that written citation, they'll put it in a box. That box will contain any written citation, and then a clerk, one of the clerks, one of the aides, will pick up that citation probably the next day, if they have time, enter it into our database, and then send it to records. And then
basically type it in, transcribe
right.
the information.
Exactly.
And hopefully they can read the officer's writing.
Exactly. and part of the dilemma with that, obviously, is penmanship, you know, to interpret some of the writings that the officers inscribe on the paper. Sometimes it's very difficult. This way it cuts down a lot of those errors, and then that paper trail continues on to the court. So in some cases, a paper citation, it can take up 7 to 10 days in all reality to get to the court. This citation electronically is available within hours upon submittal. And without the errors that we've experienced. It also enables the drivers the opportunity to address the court much, much more quickly.
Well, it also enables the officer, if it's a bogus license, you sort of seem like you could figure that out pretty quickly.
Yes.
By the barcode reading, because I'm assuming if it's made up, then there's an error that would come out, or
correct.
The information wouldn't.
Yeah, if it's not a valid barcode, no doubt. And that's one of the newer phases that we're working on right now with Department of Public Safety is the information exchange switch, where we will be able to identify driver's record history and whether or not there's other issues for us to address at
right.
that point, including the vehicle as well. So those are all things that are currently in the process that will help expedite our overall program.
Okay.
May I share one quick story? Officer issued a ticket for speeding and no insurance. He, after shift, he downloaded that morning. It was on the website, Mesa's website, because as soon as it's docketed in our case management system, it's available on the World Wide Web. The individual filed a motion to continue to, because he had registered with for defensive driving school on a speeding ticket. He sent a PDF of his insurance, and this was probably 8:30 a.m. By 10, the judge had gone through his queue, dismissed his insurance ticket, gave him an extended court date to attend EDC. There was no human communications, and the gentleman resolved the portion of his ticket that he could in one business day. So that's the value to the community.
And without that, they would have had to set a court date. He would have had to show up, right. physically present his insurance copy, got a continuation at that time, come back then, and submit the documentation for the defense, or I guess they would have done it to the court. But it would have been stretched out over weeks, probably, and at least one physical visit to the court.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
Thanks, officer.
Great. Thank you.
Final note on this slide. The obvious benefit to the court is that we save staff time and the confusion that the officer mentioned coming into the court system. We have the same issue where staff have to do manual data entry of paper citations. It's time-consuming. There's errors. There's inconsistencies. There's all kind of issues that complicate the process. The benefit to the court in saving that staff time, we've struggled, as I've mentioned to council previously, that we receive 260,000 incoming phone calls a year, and at busy times and due to staff losses, we drop about 30,000 of those calls we cannot pick up because we just can't do it. So the staff benefit in terms of not having to do citation entry, we'll move those staff over to pick up some of those 30,000 public calls coming in.
So you pick up some, right. you'll cover some inefficiencies
right.
with, okay.
Right.
Good. All right.
Les?
Yes, Councilmember Higgins.
So is that system coming forward in some budget presentation, or is this, or we're approving that?
Well, we're like, presenting it to you to include in the proposed budget.
So it's going to be, it's already included in that.
Yeah, we're yes, we've been, it'll be included in the proposed budget.
Thank you.
Last slide is our budget. It's just a snapshot. It's, you can see that there's basically no difference between last year's budget and this. There's some variations because of moving into City Edge, a different budget system, but the numbers are the same last year to this year. So we're just holding our own in terms of the budget. It's actually nice to face a budget where you don't have to actually cut in a given year. So this is actually a good year. Questions?
Yeah, Councilor Higgins.
Just on that, the second line, the other services.
Yes.
It says year-end estimate is almost like $1 million below your estimated budget. Is that because you guys are just were super efficient this year, or were you holding off on buying something to next year?
I believe that year-end estimate means that that's what we expect to expend yet in that line. So 725 will go to 1 million expense.
Oh, is there a reason that's underspent? Going to be
the
grant money
to the rescue.
To the rescue.
Our grant money of I think 1.5 carried in that line, and
the
so
proverbial grant.
Yes, the nemesis of all budgets, the grants.
Someone explain that again, Candace. Go ahead.
Right, if you look at the bottom part of that slide, if you look at the grant section, you'll see that's where the savings are. Those are grants that we have anticipated and not spent this year. The money is still available. We'll be carrying that over into the next year.
Okay.
So in the future, Council, we're going to try to strip grants out so we can have a better picture out of the have it in a separate budget apart.
So does that make sense? You're $1 million low on the expenditure, but you're also $1 million high or low on the sources.
Just the grant dollars haven't been aren't going to be spent. Councilor They'll probably carry over to the next year.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
We'll just have to work through all that. Yeah.
Thank you. I represent the Arizona League of Cities and Towns on the Arizona Supreme Court Commission on Technology, which works with your committee overseeing the work on the new case management system. Is what you're telling us today that you are on target, on track, in terms of a timely way for the case management system for statewide?
Mayor, Councilmember Kavanaugh, we certainly are. There's a lot of people involved in this project, as you know. It's driven by very tight timelines. Those are contractual. We have to turn certain requirements over to the company that's doing this based on certain times. Our next time milestone is August 10th. We have to hand over another set of requirements, which pretty much should complete the requirement part. The company then has into spring to turn that around and give us a first version of the system wherein which we can test it and make modifications leading into July 2013. So much of this is driven by contractual timelines that we're meeting.
Right. I know your staff has been working incredibly hard on this project, and there are many courts around the state that are looking with great anticipation on this. And assuming you'll be giving a report to our commission meeting in about 5 weeks.
We typically do. If it's agendized, we'll certainly be there to give an update on it. There's a lot of money involved, a lot of state money involved, as you know, and. There's about 140 courts waiting for what we're going to develop here, so there's a lot riding on our success.
Thank you, Mayor.
Anything else? I failed at the beginning to recognize Presiding Judge Matt Tafoya. Judge Tafoya, thanks for being here. I'm, you know, the things you're going over, the innovations. I go around and when I talk to people from throughout the state, the Mesa courts are generally recognized as a leader. In innovations and new efficiencies, things like that. I know you've had just a line of people coming through the new court building to look at what we're doing down there and what you've accomplished.
Yeah, so I think when I retire, I'll go to Disneyland and give tours. it's what it's like some days over there.
So thank you. We appreciate it. It's always good to be out and about and hear people say good things about city departments that are doing that are leading the pack. And that's our courts are certainly there. So thank you.
Thanks, Council.
Mr. Black, solid waste.
Thank you.
Morning, Mayor and Council Members.
Willie Black, Solid Waste Management Department, and with me this morning is Sherry Bradley. Sherry's our fiscal analyst, and she's going to be covering the budget part of our presentation this morning. First thing we want to talk about is Mesa Public Schools. We've got a great partnership with Mesa Public Schools. We introduced our recycling program to the schools in 2008 and finished in 2009. And a reminder that the reduction in, or the introduction of recycling allowed the schools to do a significant reduction in their trash service, which equaled savings for the schools. To date, we're at about $8,000 per month for the schools in savings. We've signed an intergovernmental agreement with the schools in 2011 for the service. And an example of one of our increased recycling efforts is our purging project for the end of the school year. And typically at the end of the school year, the students are cleaning out the desks and the teachers cleaning out the classrooms, and a lot of that material goes into the trash container. What we're working at this year is trying to get as much of that material into the blue barrels as possible. And the opportunity for that is the education. 74,000 students and faculty in the schools, and the more they see what goes into the blue barrel, they take that information home and they educate their siblings and their parents on how to recycle. One of our challenges this year, what we're going to try to work on, is a vendor for their food waste, both pre-consumer and post-consumer. It would be great if we can get that out of the waste stream for them. We are going to be able to introduce our green waste program, since we have existing programs already, and see what the benefits for them for the green barrel and roll-off containers could be.
Councilman Richens.
Willie, can you talk a little bit about the genesis of the food waste program discussion and the partnership with ASU that we went through? Are you familiar at all with the...
No, I'm not
familiar. Remember the, we had the students come and... We had a partnership with ASU School of Sustainability, who came and had brought some internships that helped study this thing. I went and sat through a presentation where they talked about some of the food. Scott Boucher is going to come forward. Talk a little bit about that.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. Yeah, there was a partnership that Steve Petrakowski from Solid Waste was also involved in, where with ASU and the Sustainable Cities Network, we are looking at different projects that really staff didn't have time to work on, that ASU had an urban policy class, and so they were offering up the class to do some research for the city. One of the things that they brought up was food waste, and the students had worked with Steve, and one of the things that they brought up is that Mesa Public Schools has a large amount of food waste that is generated from there, and you really do have an opportunity to segregate that waste in a pretty efficient way from those cafeterias, and that is something you could reduce what's going into the landfills. And then even they had proposed at that point too that there's opportunities to even turn that food waste into energy. So that was one of the things that they had discussed during that class, and I know Solid Waste was looking at future things that may be able to be done with that.
Correct. And there's a lot of people out there that would like to do the best solution for it is biomass and burning it for energy. Unfortunately, there's nobody with a program out there that can do that. What we take a look at is anybody that wants to do a recycling program, is we do a site visit. I personally go out there and make sure that it's really happening and that it could pass the front page test. I don't want any material from Mesa showing up somewhere that we're going to read about the proper thing wasn't done with it. We got a long way to go, and that's something that we keep pushing for. We want something that's going to last, so we'll probably start out with a pilot and move on to the full program after we have something in place. The next program, our Clean Sweep program, is our neighborhood cleanup program for Mesa residents. This is one alternative that we have to the monthly or quarterly bulk collection that is in other cities. Typically, the other cities, the charge for a resident for this type of service when it's just dropped on the curb at a monthly or quarterly basis is about $3 to $5 a month. What our residents end up paying is, this is a combined rate of 54 cents a month. 34 cents of that is dedicated to Clean Sweep and Green Sweep, and we call it the Mesa Clean and Green fee. The other 20 cents goes to the household hazardous waste fee. We've got success with our Building Strong Neighborhood initiatives, where we do an area cleanup, and we've had success in the Dobson Ranch area for a number of years for our annual cleanups. And the Lehigh community, we also have an annual cleanup that's very successful. What we want to look to do is enhance our current Clean Sweep program and see if we can't do it citywide, see if we can't move throughout the city and every resident have the opportunity to get rid of the material an easy way.
Well, would you just kind of expand, what the
cops, what would you do? Kind of just talk about generally.
For every neighborhood, typically what happens is in a neighborhood, all you have to do is have 10 residents sign up for a cleanup. And if it's just 10 people who sign up, you might have a box. If you weren't included in the sign-up, you may not know about the cleanup. And one of the things that we can do is when we have those type of cleanups, one of the ideas is possibly sending out postcards to the entire area so everybody knows about the cleanup. And that's the best way to do it, so that the boxes just don't show up one day. You haven't had the opportunity to do your trimmings or do the shed cleaning out. Everybody in this area has the opportunity, not just the 10 people who signed on the document. The other thing we have a concern with is residents talk about the liability. We have them sign an agreement that if the wrong things go in there, they're going to be responsible for it. We've had some feedback from our customers that that's a concern for them. And what we're going to do is work on that concern, and we're going to see if we can't come up with something better, because we're honestly there to help the customer with the proper disposal if something ends up in there. We're not going to hold them accountable for it. This next innovation is something we're really excited about. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to be unveiling our EVIT scholarship program, East Valley Institute of Technology. And this actually started September last year with the, we asked EVIT to do some work on our metal bins. And what they did is supplied the labor. We supplied all the materials. And what the students got was a real world experience of what welding is like. Welding is a difficult thing to do. With new metal, it's easy. When you add the deteriorating bin, the rust, it gets to be a challenge. So the kids are getting a real-world experience of this is what it's like to weld. And we've got some great feedback from the instructors, and now that they've learned how to weld on the bins, we want them welding on more bins. So what we'd like to do is a little bit of an incentive, and we're going to put up the $1,000 for 24 bins. What they're going to be able to do with the money is be able to spend it on supplies for the students or safety equipment. So you've got that little bit more of an incentive of why you want to work on these bins. They're not the most pleasant things to work on, believe it or not. Based on the bins we've contracted before with a private vendor, we're still going to have a savings of about $100 a bin. And the next step that we'd like to do is take a look at an internship program for the students, maybe during the summertime or after they get out of school. Sherry?
Good morning, Mayor, Council. Here we have our solid waste department budget. Before you, we have our fiscal year budgeted amount, 11-12. We also have our 11-12 forecasted amount, and then our fiscal year 12-13 proposed budget. And the 12-13 proposed budget has very minimal changes from 11-12.
Councilman Higgins?
I kind of have the same question as last presentation. And what's the big discrepancy between, you know, the year-to-date, the forecast, and the budget when it comes to commodities? It's like a lot.
Councilmember Higgins, the savings comes from mostly from our barrel program. We have an agreement with our current barrel vendor where we return barrels that are not under warranty, and they give us a credit based on each barrel. They give us a certain amount, so we've been able to utilize that quite a bit this year, as well as we've really been utilizing our barrels that are under warranty and sending them back, and it's a barrel for barrel. So this year, we're really fortunate to be able to realize a lot of savings with that. It is a one-time savings, not always guaranteed, which is why for 12-13, the budget has remained basically the same as 11-12.
So that's like, I don't know, what's four from, it's almost 100.
The number, the comparison, what she, the number year-to-date 11-12 was through which month?
On these ones, we only have them for through December, actually.
So that's how much they spent through December. What the forecast number is, what they're projecting at the end of the fiscal year.
Right, so you're spent. Still like down
$200,000.
700, 6 to 600,000 to 1,300, 1 million.
You're correct. We also have our barrel budget is approximately $900,000. It's a very large budget. So in addition to that, we also had what we call our BRP program, or barrel replacement program, where we go throughout the city and we actually inspect much of the barrels, and we really go out there and enforce, making sure people have lids and they're not cracked, because sometimes residents won't call in for that. Due to staffing shortages, we have not been able to accelerate that program. We are definitely looking to start accelerating that here very shortly, as well into next fiscal year.
So just as a, so it's a huge savings, over a half million.
It becomes
for the
savings
barrel.
That, correct. Yeah.
So like if your barrel's cracked, we should call, right? Because
correct.
It's under warranty and It helps the city.
And if it's not under warranty, then we definitely have it in the budget to replace it.
No, I just wondered if there's a time frame where it is under warranty, if it's fairly new. And
it's 11 years.
Oh, okay. So, see, that's our little note. If your barrel's cracked and it's under 10 years, we should call and get it replaced for free.
Don't feel bad. Call us and we'll...
Don't wait till you're 12. Yeah. Call
us. Right. Okay. That's what hopes happen.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I got a question. I'm a little confused as you look at personal services. The forecast for this year is, 6-7% below what you budgeted, from 9.2 down to 8.6 million. But then you jump right back up. Little confusing, the dip below budget and then going up to a budget that's above what you budgeted this year.
We've been managing our vacancies this year. We are getting ready to fill several of our operator positions that have been vacant for a while,
okay.
As well as we did have that little bit of a 2% increase from 11-12 to 12-13, so that will show just a little bit of a jump.
Okay, so it's a timing and actually adding.
Yeah, the 2% was
positions,
was
bodies
in 11,
in those positions.
Yeah, and the 2% would not have been in the 11-12.
Right.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. I have two questions.
Okay.
One, in the coming fiscal year, can you tell us what the status is of any requests for proposals you might be issuing for services? And then the second issue, I think the council might like to hear your proposed partnership with Mesa Public Schools in terms of recycling education.
Mayor and Councilmember Kavanaugh, I'll start with the partnership with Mesa Public Schools. What we're going to be doing is, as part of our ongoing efforts to reduce their service and show the savings, we're going to be doing a partnership. We've got one of our operators who's illustrated a book, and his wife's written two books, as I understand, and published the children's books. And we're going to be doing a partnership to introduce those schools, to the kindergarten, these books that are tailored actually to Mesa's recycling program. And the schools are going to be picking up part of the tab for that with their savings, and we're going to be picking up the other part of the tab, and we're going to hopefully have it for ongoing education. You start right there at the kindergarten, and as the students remember that, and it keeps going first grade, second, on up into the junior high and high school. So we're hoping to have the book ready in October, and with the launch, America Recycles Day in November. That's the plan for Mesa Public Schools. And as far as RFPs go, I'll get to that on the next slide for landfill and for our recyclables. And the other big RFP we have is barrels for next year.
Councilman Richens.
Where are your fuel costs in this budget? I mean, where what line is that? Is that other services? And then do you anticipate any new purchases this year? As far as vehicles?
As far as next year, we've got, I recall there's about 7 side loaders on that bid, and we've got some trucks coming in this year. Our first CNG truck should be in September, and that would be our first compressed natural gas vehicle in the fleet. We're in discussions. I'd like to test more than just one truck. I'd like to have a larger sampling, but we need to make sure that we're going to be able to fuel those trucks and we're going to be able to work on those trucks. Moving on to landfill and disposal, 75% of our trash and 51% of our recyclables are part of our intergovernmental agreement with the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community. We've requested from the community a long-term solution for disposal, and we've been in preliminary discussions with other municipalities about the possibility of a joint RFP or a joint bid for disposal. And there's a lot of interest out there. The remaining 25% of our trash is currently contracted with Waste Management Republic Services, and the remaining 49% of our recyclables is contracted with Hudson Baylor, and we're getting ready to work on that RFP as well. And there's been some interest in possibly a joint venture with the other municipalities on that one.
Councilman Fender.
Don't want to let this go by. I know you guys have been working for a long time to be able to find the best way to, you know, dispose of solid waste and the facilities we use. And I appreciate your leadership in this. There's much discussion, but being able to go and look at the other municipalities, get a buying power, you know, those partnerships, I think is really important. And some of these things that you'll hear challenged through purchasing and contracts, it's nice to see, and I think great leadership on the part of the city manager to be able to go out there and see what we can do as one of the second largest city in the valley, to be able to get better prices, save the taxpayers money, get these co-ops and these partnerships going. So great leadership here, and I know there's a lot going on behind the scenes. So thank you.
Any other questions?
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item is here a presentation and discuss the fiscal year 12-13 utility rate adjustments.
This was, Mayor and Council, this is a follow-up from a question that Councilmember Richens right. had. And so this is the chart that kind of shows that if we had implemented the rate increases that were identified last year, what would be the fiscal impact? And I think we've provided that to you. Does everybody have that in front of you?
So we just have that as an attachment.
Yeah.
So what we've done is we've categorized this into the top section, the solid waste, water, and wastewater are the ones that you would normally see on our homeowner survey because they're the ones that other municipalities have as well. And we do that comparison. And then the electric and gas, we've also provided those numbers. We don't normally include those on the homeowner survey because other municipalities do not provide those services.
So if we had raised the rates, our homeowners would be have been paying $51 more annually.
Correct.
And so this, what is that, about $5 a month? It'll save
$4.25 per month.
For
the solid waste, water, and wastewater for those particular services. They may or may not have electric or gas service from Mesa, depending on where they live.
Okay, so if they have electric and gas too, there's some additional.
Right, and we don't currently have, under my knowledge, anyone who has both the electric and gas as a customer. So they're either in the electric area or the gas area.
Really?
I'm not sure. I don't believe that we overlap.
What's that?
The electric and gas.
In downtown, we do. Don't we?
Yeah, we do.
Do we have
yeah.
the gas?
Where we have, but we have. There are customers that have all.
We have all. Everything.
They have
they're
the full package.
We own them.
The whole
we have
thing.
The whole package. They have the bundle.
So. We bundled it for them. So no, for the most of our customers, they are solid waste, water, and wastewater customers are the bulk of the customers in Mesa, and then we have our electric area, and then our various gas areas in the Magma area and the Mesa.
So by refinancing the bonds, just in review, for some customers, it looks like it's saved almost $65 a year.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
66.
For some customers. For most customers that just have
over
the
$50.
Water, yeah, over $50 a year, which is probably roughly equivalent to that secondary property tax, isn't it? That's pretty close that we have?
It's a little less. I think we're at 60.
$62.
$62.
Yeah,
$62.
Yeah,
so it's pretty close. I mean, yeah. You may want to look at it as a comparison to what a future bond which might cost you.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That was it. All right, thanks.
Okay, we've now set the standard for the length of time we expect for presentations. All remaining departments, Mr. Boucher. Environmental fee.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Scott Boucher with Environmental and Sustainability. I'm here today to give you a quick update on the environmental fee. Just a little bit of history. This fee was implemented in January of 2007 to pay for unfunded federal and state environmental mandates. And as of August 2011, the fee was $5.38 per utility account per month. Staff is not recommending any changes to this fee this year. And currently, that $5.38 generates about $10.3 million annually. Here is, without a proposed fee increase or decrease, this is the budget for next year associated with the environmental fee. You can see it covers several different departments, including transportation, parks and rec, development and sustainability, and our fleet folks. And I thought I'd give you some photos to show what we've been using the fee for this year. This is out at the Red Mountain Multi-Generational Center. There was a dirt road, kind of service road around there,
and also an area that wasn't technically a parking lot at the time, but it was being used by a lot of folks to park because that area is so, or that facility is so popular. So we did a lot of paving out there to reduce the PM10 emissions. And we have been doing a lot of stabilization throughout the city to try and reduce PM10 emissions because that is a problem we're having regionally. We also use this to do stormwater inspections. The environmental group is out doing stormwater inspections of industries and commercial facilities, including restaurants, service centers, that sort of thing. Also, we've been doing a lot of work in the retention basins, trying to fix some issues that were there. This is a photo that shows some erosion issues that were happening at basin 803. So they've installed some curbing around there to help with the flows at those basins. In addition, there's a lot of tree pruning that needed to be done. The vegetation in these basins weren't being cared for as well as they should. And so we've been using these funds to go into the basins and take care of those trees. And like I said, a lot of the erosion issues. Here's another one at Harmony Park. You can see in the storm drain. This is all part of our storm sewer system. You could see that it was in pretty dire need of being cleaned out. And this helps with flows that are going into those retention basins so you don't have standing water and those sorts of things. Here's another good example, our Quarry Retention Basin, which is over Mesa Drive in the US 60, where we had some standing water. You could see from the vegetation that's growing in that basin. And
that's your wetlands right there.
And so a lot of work that was done by transportation out there in regards to that.
I'm just okay, so that's the big, huge one right there.
Yeah.
On,
you yep. see,
I thought that was ADOT's. That's our retention basin?
Oh. We have to maintain it. We have to, yeah. We've
got to maintain it? Oh. Because that was built when the freeway was built. So we share that, huh? Mm-hmm. I've learned something today.
Yeah, we have responsibilities there.
No, it's theirs. We have to maintain it, kind of like DPS.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
To the pool.
I mean, okay. Thank you. You have educated me on some things today. I always thought that was ADOT. Go ahead.
Here's another picture, similar situation that we had at a pump station at Stapley and Brown, where you had water that was standing water. It wasn't draining properly from the retention basins, and transportation's done a lot of work there. And then a lot of work that is done is our street sweeping throughout the city, both arterials, residentials, and collector streets that's paid for with the environmental fee. So with that is my presentation. If there's any questions.
Councilman Richards.
You know, I really appreciate you putting these slides together. I think a lot of people had the perception that even through a period of austerity and budget cuts that, you know, well, the city still kind of was doing, you know, fine, and we were able to maintain things. And you look at those slides and you realize there's little hidden corners of the city that were getting neglected, that weren't getting taken care of. And that is the cost of budget cuts. That's the cost of, you know, a down economy. And so it was nice to see some of those projects move forward, you know, with this program. So I want to commend you on that. Thank you.
Well, and Mayor and Council, we appreciate the support because really a lot of the effort this year has gone into taking care of the basins that we weren't able to do until last year when we were able to address that specifically in the budget. So I think you'll start to notice, certainly you see some things in immediately, but over time, as we are able to continue to maintain and keep up the basins, I think everybody will start seeing that improvement too. So we appreciate the council's support in getting that done.
Thank you. Okay, there's no other questions. Thanks.
Thank you.
Next item is to your presentation on the neighborhood outreach and animal control budget issues. Ms. Lewis.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. We'll be brief as well.
You look slightly scrambled this morning, by the way. Thank you.
I look what?
Forget.
Okay.
Lightly scrambled.
Lightly scrambled,
and you're scrambled. Sweet butter.
Sweet butter. Buttersweet. Forget it. That's sort of an inside joke for those
of
you. Had to be there.
You
had to be there, okay?
This is an ongoing dialogue here.
unfortunately.
I'd like to, first of all, introduce the staff that are here with me today. I have Diane Brady, who oversees our animal control unit and our lead field officer. And I also have Ruth Casey, who is our administrator for the Diversity and Neighborhood Outreach Department. And so these are, you know, relatively small offices in the city, but I'm really proud to help serve them because I believe that they're also offices that have a significant impact on our neighborhoods and the quality of life for our neighborhoods. There's been one change this year in that because they are fairly small departments and because we kind of carved them out of the broader neighborhood services department, we've combined them and their budgets into one budget for budgeting purposes. So that's what you'll be seeing today. So today, our staff are going to talk about their accomplishments for 11 and 12, their priorities for the coming year, and also some of the innovations with impacts that they have created and are working on for the coming year. Then we'll review the budget, and we'll be open for any questions. So we're going to start with Neighborhood Outreach and Ruth.
Thank you, Natalie. I'm going to briefly just highlight one of our accomplishments this year, and I'd like to highlight the Building Strong Neighborhoods Initiative. It continues to grow in size, and we are reaching more and more residents every year. In 2006-07, the first year of the initiative, 1,275 households were engaged in every one of your districts. This fiscal year, we have seen that number increase, reaching almost 3,000 Mesa residents, an increase of over 130%. Meanwhile, the number of phone calls and email requests received by our three outreach coordinators, Lindsay Belinke, Cynthia Oscura Garza, and Susan Frabota, continue to rise as residents become more engaged. One of our priorities, I'd like to focus on enhancing volunteer opportunities in Mesa. Our volunteer coordinator, Michelle Alves, intends to increase outreach and advertisement by utilizing the new volunteer website and continuing to use other leading volunteer resources, increasing communication tools through our monthly volunteer electronic newsletters, and aligning volunteer opportunities with cities of service initiatives and blueprints. Among our innovations planned for the coming year is an internship program with the Diversity Office. The intern will assist in research and conduct community outreach, assist with the preparation of special events, including the community cinema series, and gather and track data such as benchmark statistics and diversity-related initiatives.
Morning, Mayor and Council. Our accomplishments for animal control, we continue to be a very busy unit. We've attended many community meetings and tried to reach out to as many citizens as possible to educate them on animal issues and increase awareness of the animal control unit. We've had quite a few tough cases this year, past year, hoarding issues and things that we've been trying to work with. Priorities, we've included education of the community, trying to increase feral cat awareness, set up feral cat management programs, set up spay and neuter programs for partnershipping with Maricopa County, Arizona Humane Society, and some different Healing Hearts mobile spay and neuter to increase spay and neuter in the city. Our innovations, we're very excited. We have restored, with the addition of our third animal control officer, we have now restored for the past few weeks the five-day service. So we're now available Monday through Friday. We had to shift some schedules around and stuff, but so far that seems to be working well, and hopefully more people will be aware and take advantage of that. We're also working
Diane?
Very...
Oh, Diane, hold on.
Councilman Kevin has a question.
Hey, Dan, I just wanted to offer some comments. You know, the last couple of years seem like you and your cohorts have been like foster children moving from home to home, and it's nice to see hopefully some stability in terms of where you're located, and particularly in being able to increase resources at many of the events in my neighborhood, in my district. Requests for animal control service are chronic, and our residents have understood this is a priority, and I know that they're going to be very gratified that you're being very creative in restoring hours to the program. And I hope it's just I want to tell people this is like phase one of working on services, because it is something that affects quality of life. And your colleagues work under very difficult circumstances, and I think have persevered really, really heroically in terms of issues that we face both during economic challenges and dealing with neighborhoods. And so to come back and talk about these innovations to us for the coming year, I think it's a very positive step. And I'm hoping that other segments of the community, Maricopa County, will work to help build some more partnerships to help augment the program that you have, because it's very important to residents. But I just want to say thank you for working through difficult times and still coming back with improvements and innovations. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Councilmember Kavanaugh. We appreciate those words still. We are working very hard with to utilize our computer services to maximize our dispatching capabilities. The system we had wasn't really set up for animal control dispatching and stuff, but the people in IT and in that handle Tidemark are really working hard on fixing that, and I think it'll be work very well for us in the future.
So with that,
hold on, Councilmember Glover.
I have a quick question for Diane. How many calls are for service are generated on the weekends?
Since we are not here on the weekends, we get them on Monday morning, and it could be that some people just hang up, so we don't know how many there could be. Other people might not be calling when they should be because they know we're not available Friday, Saturday and Sunday. But typically when we come in on a Monday morning, we could have anywhere from 40 to 80 calls holding, messages holding. Now, some of those are just a simple phone call back. Others are barking dogs that can be handled any times, but others were important calls that, a dog was chasing somebody at the moment and it was missed.
Do you think it would be beneficial to contract with the county so that they can handle the weekends then?
Well, it's not quite that easy, because services that the county provides to the other cities throughout the valley is a lot different than the services that we provide to the city of Mesa. They would only be able to respond to dogs running loose. They don't do livestock issues. They don't do barking dog issues. A bite report would be sort of problematic, because if they took a bite report, you have the 10-day quarantine period. When that's up, the people will be calling us to find out about the quarantine, and we didn't take the bite. So sometimes we might not have the information from them. So we are working with county, though, to see what they could provide. They are working on some numbers to give to us to see if that is something that is feasible. Okay. We're just not sure how it's going
to
work.
And just to add a little bit to that response, Councilmember Kavanaugh alluded to maybe a phased type of approach. In reality, that is what we're trying to do. So this year, we have a focus on, we've been able to fill what was an existing position in our field officers. That helped us move back to the 5 days per week from 4 to 5 days per week. We also are working very hard, like she said, with IT to really maximize the efficiencies of the existing system that we have, not only from tracking purposes, so that we understand what happens on a citywide basis, where there are hot spots, what types of services those are, so we have a better sense of tracking. And hopefully what we'll be able to do is, through those efficiencies, free up Diane's time so that we don't have two people doing almost full-time dispatch. We have just one, and we have four people either out in the field providing the service or
providing more community outreach, working on grants, you know, finding ways to really maximize our existing services. So that is our focus for this year. Our focus for next year, and we're not quite ready to talk about the details of that, but we have reached out, as Diane talked about, to the county. And we've asked them to give us a look at a snapshot if they were to provide us all of the services 7 days per week, because even though we believe we provide better services, it just behooves us to look at that. But we've also asked them, what would it look like? What kinds of services? What would the cost be? And what would it, and how would that be different from what we could do if they provided it on Saturday and Sunday? So that is something that we're looking into. And as we have that information, we'll provide that to you.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins?
Have we ever looked at the people we have on the street and overlapping schedules so you can service the weekend? So instead of, you know, everybody working Monday through Friday, some people are Thursday through Sunday folks.
And
so
that... That is currently what we do today.
We already have people on the street on the weekend.
No, oh, I'm sorry. What we do is, it's real important to us from a safety perspective for our staff that we always have at least two people on the street at any given time. And so for us, with the three officers that we have, and to be able to overlap that and provide the 2 days per week service, that is, we can do the 5 days right now. So right now we're not able to do the weekends, but we're looking into the options of partnering or other things that we're trying to do just to maximize what we can do.
And do you look? Do we have more hours, like the way, you know, someone comes on at 6 and someone else stays till 8 p.m. kind of thing, so that you get that after school, after work issues? Because I'm sure you get calls at that time too.
The issue with that, Councilmember Higgins, is that we have to be to the shelter by 5:30 to unload.
Right.
If we were to be later, we would have to pay them for a swing shift person, which is
that,
what we
right.
used to do.
Right. And so we can't work at night because we can't do anything with the animals you pick up.
Correct.
Okay.
Unless we were to contract for the county services
right.
at night.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
This is just a quick snapshot of the budget. And overall, we're maintaining our budget from 11-12 to 12-13. We've made both in neighborhood outreach and also in animal control very significant efforts to really study our budgets and understand them this year and move some line items around. But at the end of the year, we really have just maintained our budget and stayed even. One of the significant changes that we want to make sure council understands this year is that we are recommending that the CDBG funding that we were using in 11-12 in previous years for one neighborhood outreach coordinator now be fully funded through the general fund. So both the expenses and the staffing costs for that CDBG funded staff member would now be moved into the general fund. And with that, if there are any other questions, we're here.
I would say money well spent. Neighborhood outreach coordinators and the volunteer coordinator, I think they saved the citizens of Mesa a fortune in taxpayer dollars. I've watched it firsthand involvement over these last 4 years and just truly impressed. And that's a group that generates so much savings, and we appreciate the efforts and also the efforts in animal control. I tell you, they'd probably make a hero out of you guys if you could figure out a way to deal with feral cats. That is an ongoing, and haven't heard that solution yet, but hopefully someday a humane way to help residents deal with those things. So thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Development and sustainability is next, and we kind of fought over this last position because, you know, the saving the best for last, but of course, Christine won that argument.
Thank you, Natalie.
You're welcome.
Good morning, Ms. Salonka.
Morning, Mayor, Council. We have part of our crew here today. You know, Scott Boucher, who's over development and environmental and sustainability. Carol O'Donnell. What the heck is your name? Carol Haddad is our management assistant. You know, John Wesley, the planning director. Wanted to introduce Laura Heineman, but she's off bicycling in California today. She's our been recently promoted over code and inspections. And then Steve Heather, our building official, is off at training today. And Beth Hughes Ornelas is our over development planning. wanted to share with you our recently reconstituted vision for the department, and we actually borrowed this from our friends and sister cities in Burnaby. When I was talking to the mayor there, he came up or had come up with this idea of a complete community, which really seemed to capture what development and sustainability is trying to do, kind of that three-legged stool of sustainability, economic, social, and environmental goals. So the other way that we've talked about that is people, prosperity, and planet. So that really captures what the department is trying to do, everything from the entitlement planning through developing a good built community through code compliance and environmental compliance. Some of the technology innovations, and we are really focused on technology as are a number of other departments. That's really the way forward to maximize our resources and provide the highest level of customer service to our customers. One of the big things we've been re-implementing over this last year is our scanning project. When we went through the significant reduction several years ago, we had to stop our document management program. And this is one of our big problems right now. We have approximately 51,000 plan sets that are backlogged that have not been electronically scanned in. Creates a problem for staff, also reduces our level of customer.
Is that like your plan morgue?
Actually, that is an active plan room. When we have customers that come in that want to look at a plan set, we actually have people that have to go downstairs because there's no elevator. They have to find plans in that mess, bring them back up, and make copies for our customers. So our goal here is to actually get all of these scanned in over the next couple of years so that they can be available electronically. This would reduce the need for our customers to come down to the city office. They should be available electronically. We started working on the planning project. It's taken us about a year to get halfway through John's files. Over the next year, we hope to finish up the planning and move on to the construction.
Do we accept electronically filed plans?
Pardon me?
Do we accept electronically filed?
We do not currently have that ability. One of the innovations that we have talked about, and I'm going to get to it in a couple of slides, one of my goals is to move towards electronic plan review. We've been evaluating that over the last year, and actually it seems more cost effective to upgrade the entire Tidemark permitting system. It's 9-year-old technology. The upgrade to automation, which is a web-based application, includes electronic plan review. That's where we would to get to.
I mean, there's other cities around the valley that are accepting plans electronically, aren't there?
Yes, and there's a piece of it. We currently accept the fire construction document, the final plans that's submitted to the fire department. We currently do not have the technical capabilities to review plans electronically.
What would that take? Because, like you said, aren't those mainly web-based type
Yes.
processes?
The automation upgrade is approximately $1.9 million, and our proposal would be to implement that over 2 years. The cost just to do the electronic plan review component was about $600,000. And in fact, we had that included in this last year's budget, paid for by the technology fee that we adopted about 4 years ago. But in working with ITD, it seemed very clear that the most cost-effective way to move forward would be to upgrade the whole permitting system, which would include the electronic plan review. That's where we would like to get to over the next couple of years. But we'll talk about that in the budget section.
Good.
Okay. One of the other innovations that we would like to work towards this year is adoption of the 2012 International Codes, and that's the International Family of Codes, electrical, mechanical, etc. We're currently only on the 2006 version of the codes. We made a budget decision a few years ago not to upgrade the codes, but we're really so far behind now this next year. We really do need to upgrade to...
Well, I think that was our budget, and also the... as I recall, we talked about this 3 years ago or
yes,
so.
Yes, we did.
It was not only our budget, but also in deference to the economic situations and the recognition that builders and contractors would have to go through and update their plans. And I think we also deferred to the economics to say, listen, we're not going to make you go back and upgrade your plans in these times.
Yes.
It's so tough. So I think it was a combination of both of
you're
it,
absolutely
if I remember
right,
correctly.
Sir.
Okay.
Most of the other cities now are moving towards the 2012 version, and what our customers want is consistency. They don't want different codes. One of the really very neat things about the 2012, it does have sort of a smart link component to it, where if somebody gets a comment, go to section XYZ, they could actually hot link to that section of the code rather than pulling out a book and having to go through it. So we think, again, that that would be a huge increase in service to our customers as they're
I'm
going
I'm assuming
through.
If someone's building in another city to 2012 code that it would probably, I don't know that there would be many things that would not comply with 2006 code.
There's actually, Steve Heather, this week.
I'm imagining that we're not reducing standards from code to code. If that's the case, that would be the first time I'd ever seen that.
No, they wouldn't be reduced from a life safety standpoint, from a building safety standpoint. There's always revisions. We're in the process right now of evaluating what is the difference between the 2006, the 2009, and then the 2012 code. So before we begin to talk about implementation, we would come back and share what those changes are with you. Workload innovations, and we've talked about this probably every year for the past 4 years, we continue to use temporary workers to manage workload fluctuations. We are down to a very lean, mean, and very effective staff, but when we have big projects come in, when we have a project come in that wants expedited review, we are currently able, through the budget process, to bring in temp workers or to bring somebody in on overtime so that we can meet that demand for quick turnaround. That continues to be a very effective model for us. It allows us to be ultimately flexible without adding additional FTEs to respond to fluctuating workloads.
Do you feel like you're meeting expectations? I mean, what's the feedback you're getting from from the community? I mean, of course, we always hear, it's never fast enough for people, and I don't know what reality is. I mean, I've been in the business. I know that you'd love to have every plan be a counter review. That's not going to happen. But what I mean, honestly, are we keeping up? Do you think we're well prepared? Because if we're not, let us know so we can see if we can get your resources to get us well prepared. Because this is, you know, part of our startup initiative, and part of the deal is to make this where people feel like we're helping them succeed. And part of that is by not creating undue delays in reviews of plans.
Mm-hmm. I would say we are hanging on by the skin of our teeth.
Okay, so we're struggling
right now. I think
okay. I mean, that's an honest.
Yeah, we're making it happen, and I think it's through very creative use of our staffing and our temporary workers.
Okay.
For the most part, I think we greatly exceed expectations, but there's always a balance there. There are projects that come in that Bill Jubjaniak and I meet on a monthly basis. We identify the really high priority economic development projects, and if there is a justification for pulling those projects ahead of others, that's a discussion that we have with the city manager's office and with economic development. We make it happen.
So you have no excess capacity.
There is absolutely no excess capacity.
That you're using temporary, there's no excess capacity, and so that is something we need to look at, especially if as I hope happens, you're finding more projects come in. I'm assuming that if what I'm hearing from other cities, they're actually getting things like plats, and commercial projects are starting to trickle into other departments as construction and development activity recovers a bit.
I'm jumping ahead here, but our revenues this year are over $1 million ahead of what the budget projections were, and that's both on the planning side as well as the development services.
Let us know, because I really appreciate what you've done, and I know you guys have been more up and down and yo-yoing with because of the activity, but I want to make sure that we're ahead of the game and that we're not trying to prove how frugal we can be, and by doing that, we create undue obstacles, because I think part of our way of getting out of this mess is to really provide the kind of service that that is second to none, and that includes our neighboring communities. Councilman Richens.
With this economic downturn, it's been interesting seeing the housing recovery, and as part of that, my neighborhood's about 50 years old, and as part of that, we have a lot of remodeling activity, people acquiring distressed properties and fixing them up, and the feedback I hear the most is with these small projects, the small addition, the remodel, that doing some major work inside, that's where we're struggling. So if there's anywhere that I would propose that we add capacity, it's to help those small homeowners, because we don't want them to get so disenchanted with the system that they start doing it without permits. Because mm-hmm. I think that's where we're headed. And I'm worried about that, because when that happens and you don't have the electrical inspections, you start having problems, and it starts spilling over into the fire department instead. And so if there's any, yeah, a couple, present company accepted.
One of the things that I'd like to mention there, over this past year, we have reinstituted the development information specialists, and that's basically an over-the-counter review for small projects, swimming pools, small additions, Arizona rooms, those kinds of things. And that was a service that we had to cut when we went through the huge reductions, and you're exactly right. Then somebody that comes in with, you know, mom and pop, a simple project, they basically had to get in line with everything else. And we've tried really hard to get some of that over-the-counter review back, but you're right. Typically, those are the projects that are going to end up taking probably the maximum turnaround time.
Right.
Our published turnaround time that we meet about 99% of the time is 10 working days for residential and 18 working days for commercial.
Let's talk about that. Get a set of red lines on day 10, and then they're back in the queue again for another 10
let's,
days.
And I understand your struggle, but let's talk about
it's
that.
It's the counter
because
service that I
that's
think
what we hear.
Really,
those small projects, unfortunately, there's 50 of those small projects. And so what happens is that people have an experience that may not be out of the realm of normal, but their expectations are not met. Those 50 talk to another 50, talk to another 50, and before you know it, we're viewed as being completely unresponsive. I know that's not the case, but maybe we need to really look and see if we can come up with the what do you call that?
Development information specialist?
Yeah, like a counter thing that says, listen, if you have a project under such and such, boom, this is what they're going to handle, almost mm-hmm. like segregating that. And if we need more resources, we need to maybe look and see what we can do to implement that, because I would really like to see those small projects be able to go through literally, if not on a counter, then maybe a less than a week, we get all the red lines and get someone in and out of there. And I get it that if you may need some more resources for that. But let's look at ways we can do that.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the discussion about the basins earlier, where it's like this is the hidden parts of Mesa where when we had to make cuts, this is where the service slipped. Mm-hmm. You know, and we tried to make it as, you know, I can't think of the right word for it, but so people didn't see it, didn't feel it, but it there was an impact on all these budget cuts, and this is a really, really big one, and so I think we need to get to this level of service.
Around a little bit and see what.
Okay, we'll work with the city manager's office and come back on that. The one thing I would like to emphasize, that hits the planning piece of it also. John's staff right now, we've got so much coming in on the commercial side. We've got some huge developments that are coming in. And we have basically the same issue there where somebody comes in, they want their plat done right now. And he is very resource constrained. So we're pulling temps in on the planning side also to try to meet that expectation. But we'll work on that and see if we can.
Yeah, And you mentioned you have a big project coming in. That's the thing that team seems to suck resources, and we want those to work.
Right.
We don't want to leave the impression that the little guy who is our bread and butter and every day, and they're our neighbors, mm-hmm. is somehow secondary, because to them there's only one project you're dealing with.
Right.
We throw around, we're dealing with 500, 600. No. To the guy who needs to fill in his garage, that's the only project that's going on in the city right now.
Right.
And somehow we need to figure out a way to equalize those. And I know that takes resources, and I know that have been completely taken away from you with this downturn. But now that we maybe have a little bit of breathing room, and we know we're going to have an uptick in activity in your area, you're going to feel it just like you felt the downturn. You're going to feel the upswing more than any other department. So, keep us up to date on what we can do to maybe balance those. And give the person that's doing the garage remodel or the kitchen remodel, make them feel the same importance as the person who's going in and doing the commercial corner.
Okay.
And I know that's a challenge. It's a big challenge.
One of the programs that I've kind of thought about, we do have a permit by inspection program. And perhaps for really basic kinds of construction, there's a way that we could work with our building inspectors to kind of do an on-site review. So I think there's some options out there and things that we haven't instituted in the past that we can look at and see, is there a better way that we can deal with the homeowners?
Well, and a lot of it, as you know, is when someone who's doing their garage generally has no idea how the process works.
Exactly.
And so I don't know how we get them into that information stream where when they come up and basically you say, not if you have a small project. They don't know what a small project is. Right. If you're remodeling your kitchen or filling in your garage or whatever, go to here and here's how we can make it work. Mm-hmm. I think some of the things we need to do is on the front end, get out of the bureaucratic speech, which we are also good at, and talk in normal terms, which is, hey, if you want to put in your pool, here's it. If you want to fill, you know, define the kind of project, because those are what people relate to. And send them this way or that way. And I think a lot of the times we can avoid these problems if we put them into the right line and get them into the right pipeline. Because I've known a lot of people who have been over here on this part of the department messing around for something they should have been able to go there, but they didn't know which way to go, and they got lost in our system. And that's something I think we can really work on too.
One of the things we tried to do is make a lot of that real basic information available electronically and by brochures. You know, if I'm just a homeowner, I really don't know how to draw a plan set. Well, if all I'm doing is filling in my carport, you know, maybe we can provide some clearer process information through, you know, follow these steps, follow this checklist,
exactly.
and you can get
and
there.
And people need to know it's easy. The portal to get into that is easy to get to. And that gets with the city website and all sorts of things that I think we can do. Okay.
We'll continue to work on that.
Thank you.
I like the concept, the permit by inspection thing for small remodels, because I think that lets people get started. And then if they know what points of their project they need to have somebody come and take a peek at it, I think that gets us a long way down the road without having to go through drawing plans and the additional expense of the architects.
And that may be a factor of taking some of our more senior building inspectors and giving them additional training so they could do that sort of on-site plan review, because there is another skill set there when you have to be able to look at how's the electrical, how's the plumbing, that kind of thing. And looking at the plans is different than doing the inspection. So we'll definitely look at that and see what we can do using...
Great.
Yeah. Okay, one of the other things we wanted to talk about, self-certification program. We had talked about that, I think, in a subcommittee meeting. Phoenix actually has a pilot program that's been in place for about 3 years now. And basically what that requires the applicant, that would be the registered architect or engineer, to self-certify that their plans are 100% complete and they're in compliance with the code. I was talking to Phoenix just last week. They only have about 10% of their projects that have come through under self-certification. So we're going to look at a pilot program there, work with our registrants, and see if we can't move forward with a pilot program.
And the reason for that is, are there added burdens to the professional who's going to self-certify?
Technically, no.
Right.
Because currently when
they stamp it, they're certifying.
Yes.
Yeah.
However,
but that's not how it works.
Yes, but there is something of, I think, a hand-holding process that they've become very comfortable with, that if they're not 100%, they submit them to the city, and our plans examiners will find the deficiencies. Well, if you're self-certifying, you're not relying on the city to do that. So we need a core of applicants that are comfortable basically saying, okay, what I'm submitting is ready to build.
I'm baffled by your statement. So you have a licensed professional who is stamping a plan, and by that stamp, basically based on professional standards, should be certifying, but you're saying that they don't feel comfortable enough to stand by their stamp.
Well, I think it's interesting.
I think that I can see where that's happening, but that still baffles me.
Yeah, I would agree, sir.
Yeah.
Mayor, I think this was brought up, the same issue happened when we were trying to eliminate the process of putting solar.
Oh, permits for solar.
Permits for solar. And we were trying to do a good thing by eliminating the bureaucracy and allowing the folks who have the license to do it to sign off of it. They didn't want to touch it because of the liability. So that's the same. So, yeah, the problem is they'll put their stamp on it, but they want the city to sign off,
well,
too.
They're still not abdicating responsibility. They just...
They just like to share it.
Yeah.
I thought it was fascinating that only... I'm sorry. That only 10% of...
Well, yeah. The idea is that they would clamor for it and that people would just jump at it, especially on larger projects and things where, you know, you have pretty big firms that are involved in this. Yeah.
The reality on the really big projects is where we have a lot more involvement on code issues and trying to do code modifications and figure out how to make that process work.
Well, you know, the thing is, and I think you need to look at what our process is on a lot of, especially the big projects. It's not so much as the city is all-knowing. It's that it's always good to have two sets of eyes.
Right.
I mean, even the best professional needs a review process, and that really has nothing to do with regulation as much as that's just common sense. But I know a lot of professionals don't. I mean, when I was a professional, I never put anything out of my office that didn't have a review by someone at my level within my office. But I learned that from working at a firm like Pricewaterhouse, where you didn't do those things. I've since seen a lot of other professionals that don't go through that same process, and so they need the city is their second set of eyes. So I get that there's a balance there. But
it becomes particularly important when you're dealing with fire safety issues,
yeah.
Hazardous materials, unique fire suppression systems, where a lot of times it really is a learning process for both sides. You've got new chemicals,
yeah.
New processes.
Well, a lot of times these architects and engineers, this may be the only project they're dealing with in that year, and they're just not up. It's just not something they do every day.
Right.
Whereas our inspectors, that's what they do every day,
exactly.
All year long. Okay.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. There's a balance there. But we would like to move forward with a
sure.
pilot program this next year, see how many of our applicants are interested in signing up. A critical piece of that, though, is the city having an audit function, that if you come
right.
in and you self-certify, that then we review the plans to make sure there's not a problem. The worst case would be a critical flaw that's found in the field when it's being constructed. That would be really an untenable situation. So, again, there's a balance.
Well, I think
there.
Once again, there is an education process.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the issues we have is the communication with the owner or the developer, the professional, and the city. And I think the trade-off for self-certification is you expedite the project.
Absolutely.
The risk you run is that by expediting the project, you do put yourself in a situation that you may get in the middle of construction and find out that your professional made a big mistake.
Right.
And I think that's where that's where we need to be very, very diligent, is making sure that not the professional, but that owner or developer understands, here's what the risk you're running, and here's what
right.
could happen. We're willing to go down that road because we want to help you accelerate this project. But understand that if there is something big, that's going to be the worst time in the world to find that. So you choose. I mean, I like giving people choices.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how we should work with the market, is that we give them options. And if they want to take that option, that's great. They're still going to scream and yell when they get down that road. But I don't feel as badly in that case if they understood up front that was one of the potential consequences.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we more to come on that.
Okay, that's great.
Topics a little bit here. One of the major innovations that Scott and his crew have come up with is the idea of an energy efficiency fund. And this really started with the stimulus money that we received 3 years ago now, the $4.2 million for energy efficiency projects from the Department of Energy, where our goal on that was really to leverage that money to start projects, but then realize the savings, document the savings, and use that money to continue to fund additional energy efficiency projects. To date, we've had about $381,000 of realized energy savings and over $236,000 of rebates from SRP. And that was really the first time that the city had gone after the SRP energy rebate. So we're very excited about our progress on that. We have agreed to set up an energy efficiency fund with the other departments. Great example of that this coming year, where we've cobbled together money from facilities, parks, rec, and commercial facilities, and the energy fund to do major renovations at the convention center, including lighting, mechanical, and automation. And we will try to continue that, again, leveraging those initial funds so we continue to see the benefit of the savings over time. Another innovation on the environmental side of it, we would really like to look at or explore options for a permanent household hazardous waste facility. For the past probably 10-plus years, we've been doing 4 events a year, 2 at Center Street, 2 on the east side. That provides only 4 opportunities a year for our residents to get rid of household hazardous materials. We would like to look at a public-private partnership to have a permanent facility or maybe a couple of them so that logistically it works across the city where residents could come more frequently. Perhaps it's several hours a week. We don't know what the model is yet. There's no cost that we're looking at in this next fiscal year, but Scott and his group are going to be evaluating options and then coming back with proposals on how we might work a private public partnership to increase the service on hazardous waste without increasing the cost. One of the issues that we have come to terms with based on the cuts that we've had is that from an administration perspective in environmental, they deal with so many grants, so many contracts, that we have a need for an additional management assistant in that area to provide audit functions and really to provide that administrative support that, quite frankly, we have fallen down on over the last couple of years. We just don't have the people to maintain the review of those programs. So the proposal is an additional management assistant, basically reestablishing that position. It would be fully funded by the environmental fee, so revenue neutral relative to the general fund. Capital improvements, really the only project we have is our ongoing 6th Street groundwater remediation. That's our leaking underground storage tank, or our LUST project, where many years ago we had leaks from the fuel operation in the city. We are finally at the point where we're actually cleaning that up. We found more contamination out there than we had previously been able to find, and Scott's group has done a great job of getting that system up and running. They need approximately $275 additional in the CIP. Right. So we're hoping to actually get that cleaned up and closed out sometime in the near future. Okay. Again, getting back to our revenues in development services for 11-12, the projected revenues had been just under $3.5 million, and in planning, just under $380,000. Our year-end projections as of March of 2012, $1.4 million exceeding the projected revenues for the entire department. One of the other things we've been talking about over the last several months with Tammy Albright's group is the funding model for code compliance. We're proposing moving two of the current 6 CDBG-funded code officers over to the general fund, leaving 4 CDBG officers working in the CDBG-eligible areas of the city. Other innovations?
Yes, sir. Councilman Kavanaugh.
This is a question. I think this is a positive move, and I know you know it from all the comments we hear from around the community about sometimes the limitations that we have with the CDBG-funded positions. Have you explored the possibility of, in addition to this, again, adding at least another position for the for code compliance? Because this continues to be a very important issue from a residential standpoint. If you ask me as a resident, you know, what's a priority? If you're going to be adding staff, this is where you need to be adding staff. And for a whole variety of reasons for preserving the quality of life and improving it in neighborhoods. So has this been one of the areas that you've looked at for additional staff?
We did actually look at that. You're absolutely right. There's a critical need for it out there. We do not have any additional positions funded at this point in time for next year. Quick look at our budget. This is for the entire department, including environmental. The personal services budget pretty much stays constant from 11-12 to 12-13. The major changes that you'll see there in commodities and purchase capital goes to the stimulus funding, that the majority of that money will be spent by the end of this fiscal year. A very minimal amount of it will roll over to next year. So that's the big change you see in both the commodities and purchase capital portion of the budget.
Hey, Christine, I guess I'm missing something here. On the slide back, slide 12, you have revenues exceeding projections, $1.4 million.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? How does that play out in your budget spreadsheet here?
That does not play out into the budget spreadsheet, sir. There's not a revenue section on that.
We have operational resources by funding source. Isn't that basically a revenue, or where you're getting things from? I mean, you would, where do your fees show up and your and those kind of things show up?
Candace?
Ms. Candace, you want to show how that works for us?
When we're looking at these spreadsheets here, we're just looking at their expenditure budget only. So you're not actually seeing the revenues come into here. So we're just looking at the expenditure side. Now, at the same time, when we review their budget, just as we review the entire city budget, we look at the revenue side and the expenditure side. So right here, we're just showing their expenditure side of their budget.
But Candace, that summary of the revenues, the permits, is on that summary that we gave the council at the beginning, the
That's
summary
correct.
Of our revenues. We can bring that back. Remember when we gave the beginning, we show sales tax, it's included in there.
Okay, it's not done.
Not in here.
Right. What we don't show in these departmental budgets is a net number. We don't try to net any of those things out. It's just the expenditure side. That's also a phased approach to the new budgeting system.
So the operation resource by funding source is just the flow through after it's collected, where it flows through on the budget.
Right. The funding source is what type of a fund are they using for their particular expenses. So when they're in their department, they have general fund. You see they also have, in Scott Boucher's area, they have the environmental fee that they're using, so that you'll see that down below. And so that's where the bottom half of the slide is showing you where the funding is coming from.
So on this one, the fees, the $1.4 million would show up in the general fund as that fees and other sources of revenue.
It actually says permit.
That other line.
It's actually permits.
Fees,
permits
and, I think it's the other thing. And that's where that would show up.
Yep.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So with those kind of increases coming in, then let's look at that. If you're having that kind of increase, then that represents the uptick in activity, right?
Correct.
Right. And we had identified those. The number you're seeing here today is consistent with the number we've shown you to the council before. And we want to be somewhat cautious because we've noticed in both our sales tax and obviously reflected in our building permits, there is a significant spike. We know that there was certainly one specific project that created a lot of that. So whether or not this is a recurring opportunity.
And that's what I want to get to.
So we're going to continue to monitor that and go into the next year. We're pretty certain we're not going to see a million square feet of manufacturing every year. So
what you're saying is that as we look at adding positions and adding that kind of stuff, you're saying, you know, yeah, we have this uptick in activity, but we don't think that that's recurring. For right now, let's plan to put a hold on things until we see if there is a trend.
Correct.
Because right now we have a couple of big projects, but that doesn't represent a trend. And so when we look at our personal services budget, that which is basically holding steady.
Right.
And it's holding steady even with the those are just transition on sources from CDBG over to
but it's important on the CDBG people. That's, you know, kind of maybe to Councilmember Kavanaugh's question, we've really tried to be careful about the amount of dollars we've added into positions.
Right.
And we first kind of the discussion we had early on council, we added took four positions that were currently funded by CDBG and are now in the general fund. So that puts that pressure.
But the reason we did that was to expand or take off. First of all, CDBG was being reduced.
Right.
So in some way, we didn't have a choice but to decide whether we were going to pick those up in general and fund the general fund. The secondary reason, as I understand it, is that with CDBG, there are certain restrictions because there's limitations because they're CDBG. By funding the general fund, we hopefully pick up some flexibility and some efficiency because those code compliance officers can then be used at our will rather than based on the confines and the restrictions put on by CDBG.
And I think we've done that this year to start, if you would, to allow, you know, take for all those reasons moving out CDBG. I think what we'd like to look at is let's see what happens during the year as far as our revenues, and certainly as a priority next year. I think we all agree we need more code officers.
But we're not adding more code officers.
But we're moving them so they can be more, what's the word?
Effective.
Broader. They have a broader area to provide service in the city.
That's right.
Yeah, I think first we have to complete this transition, getting them out of CDBG into the general fund, and then you start talking about how you.
And just so people know if they're listening, one of those restrictions are with CDBG, you're limited geographically.
Right.
As to where those officers can work, and whereas if we fund them, which means that they can't work citywide. If we fund them general fund, that's one of the restrictions. Now they're free to work citywide. So just by that alone, because I know one of the complaints that I hear is, gee, you have this part of the city where it doesn't seem like you're doing anything. And to be honest, that may be true because we don't have a compliance officer that can actually cross the line, so to speak, and work in that section of the city. So we have more capabilities in under CDBG funding, but in restricted areas of the city. If we open up general fund, they can go citywide if we so choose.
Well, and the council, just to remind the council, the program we used also during the downturn, and that's maybe compounding problem a little bit, is outside of the CDBG eligible areas, we actually had our building inspectors doing some of the code. Now, if they're getting so busy that they can't spend time, then I think it needs to be looked at as a priority as we go into the next year in all those areas. But the good news is we are being able to shift more into general fund, and we will get more coverage across the city from these officers.
Well, I think the good news is, as you said, we went into the downturn understanding here's what we're going to do to cover during the downturn. But what that also did is that expanded our capabilities and set us up for when things came back. Now we can use a hybrid program and ease into another one. So we're set up, I hope, better to handle the prosperity, because we did a good job in handling the what?
Austerity.
The disprosperity. The anti-prosperity.
Certainly that's our goal.
The counter-prosperity?
Yeah.
Come on, doctor. What was the one you...
Discontinuous.
The discontinuous prosperity. Yeah, okay. All right.
That's basically everything we have. If there are any additional questions
or comments. Any other questions?
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Okay, acknowledge receipt of minutes. Really Councilmember Higgins, second by the Vice Mayor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Any reports?
Councilmember
Higgins.
A quick point of personal privilege. I wanted to wish my oldest son a happy 21st birthday. Yes, I'm old. And I want to put a warning out to those people not carding kids that just turned 21. You better start carding kids that look 21, okay?
Okay.
He walked in and was able to buy lottery tickets without someone carding him. I'm not happy.
Councilmember Richens.
Well, you don't need ID to ride the bus. So I actually last Monday represented the city, it was Tuesday, speaking at the Arizona Transit Association conference about our transit program and land uses that we're planning and hoping to facilitate around our new light rail extension. It's a great conference. It was very well attended from people around the state. Thanks.
Thank you. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. Last night I attended a meeting for the open house for the Central Main expansion for light rail. It was very well attended by many of the stakeholders, business owners, and operators. And I think very good information presented to the community and business owners on the assistance and information that will be available to them. And I know from Valley Metro Rail standpoint, we're looking very hard at a groundbreaking date, hopefully in the last week of May, and to get that going. So it was a very positive meeting last night. Thank you.
Good. A couple, three. Last Friday, I had the opportunity attending the Friends of the United Food Bank breakfast. We have a wonderful organization here in Mesa that actually serves, their service area goes far beyond the city of Mesa, into the East Valley, even into northeastern Arizona with the United Food Bank. I really appreciate the work they do. And great turnout. And Bob Evans, who's been president, is heading toward retirement. Wish him the best and are confident that the United Food Bank will continue. Also, my youth committee, the mayor's youth committee, did a great service project last Saturday out at Geometry Park. Went out and helped them paint tree trunks to save the beautiful stand of citrus that we have there as part of Geometry Park, which was great. And then I had also had the opportunity of attending two Relays for Life for the American Cancer Society, one at Red Mountain High School, and then went over to Dobson High School for one in the afternoon, and well over a couple thousand Mesa residents and those from the surrounding community raising money for a great, great cause. And then, of course, yesterday or 2 days ago, we did the ribbon cutting on the park and ride. 2 days ago. I've lost that. To recognize the opening of three park and rides in Mesa, one at Gilbert Road and McDowell, another one up at Power Road and the 202, and then the third one at Country Club just south of the US 60. So a lot of good stuff happening. I think that covers most of it. All right, Mr. Brady.
Yes, thank you. Just to remind the council, we will not have a study session on May 3rd. We're lacking a quorum that day. So, yet there is a council meeting May 7th. so we don't have time to do a agenda review on the Thursday before. So we'll put, we'll get it out there in time. If you have any questions, please feel free to call the staff during the week. But we will see the council next at a study session on Monday, May 7th. Just a reminder that Councilmember Kavanaugh is having the wildly popular Flow Rider and Pancake morning tomorrow. Saturday, we'll have his pancake breakfast at the Flow Rider. So we invite residents to support the food bank by bringing a can of food to the event.
That was it. Councilman Kavanaugh.
And also, just to clarify on the food donation, United Food Bank has a great program of encouraging kids to bring peanut butter and jelly.
Oh.
To because for the summer food programs, they make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for kids, and so we think it's a great opportunity for kids to and their parents to come and make a donation and then enjoy the great facility that we have. The pool will be open, Flow Rider will be open. The Hilton, once again, is partnering with the city to help provide food in addition to the great food cooked up by firefighters.
And it's at Rhodes Junior High.
It's at Rhodes Junior High Aquatics Complex.
Okay. Great. Ms. Crockerton, do you have a request to speak?
No request, Mayor.
Have a motion to adjourn from the Vice Mayor, second Councilmember Higgins. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you very much.